You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jason and Jamie. And this is episode 45, if you can believe it. Jamie, the time has flown by. We're somehow already at 45 episodes. But we're in a series right now talking about the atonement of Jesus Christ. What did Jesus accomplish on the cross? Why did Jesus need to die on the cross? And these are really some questions that people are asking, because once we get into the gospel and once Christians begin to open up what the death of Christ actually means, it usually pulls on a whole bunch of other areas. And so that's why we want to talk about what our need is. We talked about the last couple episodes, we talked about our sinfulness and just how sinful our condition is. And today I was going to start by talking a little bit about the law. So Jamie, I mean, when you think of the law of God and what its whole purpose is, what are some things that come to mind for you?
Yeah, so I really see two primary functions in Scripture. Obviously, it was to set apart the people of God. So some facets of the law or some aspects of the law seem really just to be there to showcase the people of Yahweh as being different than the world, just to set them apart. You know, this is sort of the rationale behind circumcision, you know, to be marked, to be set out, set apart for, and certainly that continues on with the rest of the law as we move into the Mosaic covenant as well. And then, of course, we have, you know, what we're told in the New Testament, which is the law is there to show us our need for Messiah, to show us that we cannot live, we cannot walk, we cannot achieve in our own strength, by our own power, by our own merit. And in fact, to a great degree, this is the story of the Old Testament, right? Is the people committing to this covenantal relationship and yet failing time and time again. In fact, failing almost immediately after they commit and recommit. And so just really shows the fact that we're not able. And that's one of the big facets. In fact, the Apostle Paul talks a lot in Romans about the fact that the law is there to show us how sinful we are, to show us how desperate our state, to show us how great our need is for Messiah.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because I was just opening up to Romans, and I mean, this really is one of the chief texts that talk about this, but Romans 3:19 and 20 says this: "Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin." And so, yeah, I mean, when we talk about the law, we're talking about, this isn't just some abstract set of rules that God decided, okay, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, let's have you live this way. No, the law is an expression of God's goodness, his character, his nature. And so when we read about the law, and especially I'm thinking of, Jamie, like the Ten Commandments, for example, we see it's not something complicated, really. I mean, it's very straightforward. That's the moral law. And that's something, as we're going to talk about, I think that intuitively, at least the laws that relate to, or the Ten Commandments that relate to human relationships, that's something that people know just because God's given them a conscience and they're aware, they're accountable for behaving a certain way. But you're right. When you look at the law, in a sense, God is putting a impossible wall in front of us that nobody can jump over. Nobody can climb over the top of this wall. And he's saying, look, this is my standard. This is because I am holy, because I am righteous and good. I am making this the benchmark for being in a relationship with me. Now, that creates a problem for us. And, I mean, Jamie, maybe talk about what is it about the law that, I mean, maybe we should just start talk about why is it that we are incapable of fulfilling the law?
Yeah, I think the main reason is that the law of sin and death, as Paul puts it, is what rules, you know, our flesh, what rules our mindset. In fact, you know, you really go back to Adam and Eve and look at, you know, here they are, perfect in God's perfection, in perfect relationship with God directly, and yet they still decide, no, that's not good enough for me. I actually want to be God. And, you know, as a result, sin and death comes into the world. And we haven't gotten away from that at all. And you really see that played out. So I think, first of all, we can't do it because our natural state is towards rebellion, not towards the glory of God, at least in an inherent state. And then also we are not even able to keep our own commitment to walk in that way either. In fact, so often even the efforts to obey the law or to follow the law, what ends up happening is we end up doing these actions and actually missing out on what it is that's actually trying to be accomplished. You know, Jesus talks about that in terms of what, you know, how we view the law versus what God's perfect standard in the law is, and how dramatically different they are. You know, the obvious ones are, you know, if you have a lustful thought, that's the same as having committed adultery, or if you hate somebody, then you've murdered them. You know, and we're like, wait, hold on, what? We're following the law here. Like, we haven't committed adultery, we haven't murdered somebody, and you're telling us we're still violating the law because we're missing the actual standard of the law, as opposed to. And so it's just like at every level, we just in our flesh have a complete incapability of being able to follow the righteousness of God and live that way in our own power, in our own strength.
Well, and something interesting about the law itself, and of course, we're using that law speaking primarily of the moral law, but I mean, when we think of all the law that God gave Israel through Moses, built into the law, in Leviticus especially, we see there's this whole sacrificial system. And so, I mean, in a very real sense, God is saying, here's the moral law, which I know you're not going to keep, and here's these additional sacrificial laws that will take care of the sin that you're going to commit. And it's as if... And it's not to say God is setting us up for failure, but it's as if he knows we're going to fail at keeping the law. It's not something where God is genuinely expecting perfect obedience in our sinful condition, but we need to see it for what it is. And that's why the law is so important, because no person can read the Ten Commandments. You know, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not lie. And then when we know that God's heart behind that command, do not kill, is really do not even hate your brother. When we know that is the standard, nobody comes even close to keeping the law. And that's just the reality that God put in from the beginning, that we will need some kind of sacrifice. There needs to be some kind of way to take care of this violation of his holiness.
Yeah, and he even gave us specifically what that is. I mean, go back to Genesis 3. You know, he talks about how this is going to be accomplished. So it's like from the perspective of God, he knows and has this plan and had this plan. It's not a response to what we did, obviously. He knew what Adam and Eve were going to do, responded to it, had a plan for it. So the Old Testament really reveals that to us in shades, I guess you'd say, as we move along. But that's not God trying to, okay, man, how am I going to solve this problem? How are we going to deal with this problem? I really don't know what I'm going to do. No, it's we start out with this promise in Genesis 3, and then slowly we see more and more shades as that picture becomes even more and more clear to us, to the degree that by the time we get to the arrival of Jesus Christ, we should have been fully expecting divine Messiah. Now, they weren't, but had they been paying attention, they certainly should have been.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, John Calvin said, the law is like a mirror. So what we would often think of ourselves as, good and, generally good and basically all right, the law basically shows us the reality. You know, if you have, who knows, if you've just been in a, I guess I'm thinking of an example, like if you've had a really tough break and you haven't looked at yourself in the mirror for a while, you may be thinking in your head, I must still look like I last did when I saw myself. And then the mirror shows you the truth. It shows you the reality of what needs to be fixed. If you wake up in the morning and you have hair all over, you have stuff that needs to be taken care of. That's the whole purpose, is it's showing us that we haven't kept the standard and that something needs to be done. And so that's why all of it really is to point to Christ. If we don't have a law to show us our sinfulness, then why do we need a Savior? That's the whole idea. We're not going to be seeking any help. We're not going to be seeking any rescue or redemption until we see just how bad our condition is.
Yeah, I think the great another great analogy was the one you used. I think you used it two or three episodes ago, where you're talking about counterfeiting. How they, wasn't that you that was talking about that? How they train to recognize counterfeit money by getting closer to the real thing. So the law serves that purpose, right? It shows us what the holiness of God looks like. And even the ritual cleansing things, they speak to the character and nature of God. They speak to the purity of God. They speak to the spotlessness of God. They speak to, so it's like, it's all there designed to show us the beauty, the glory of God, his perfection, and the closer we get to the glory of God, the more desperately aware we become of our human state.
So let's talk about the holiness of God, because it, I think, is a concept that it sounds maybe familiar to a lot of Christians, and maybe non-Christians have heard this idea. But when we say God is holy, what exactly are we saying?
Yeah, that's a huge topic, right? The holiness of God is not one reality, but it is just the sum total of who God is. So it begins with the realization that God is, and that God does and has a character, has a nature that is so complete and so perfect. In fact, we're told that God is all powerful. He is sovereign. He is the Lord of all creation. He's the creator, sustainer, and orderer of all things. And yet at the same time, there are certain things God cannot do. For example, God cannot lie. God cannot sin. God cannot change. These things, you know, even them speak to the perfection of God's character, of his nature, of all the beauty and glory that is represented in him.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that more than any other attribute, God is called holy in the Bible. And I think that, you know, even like one of the persons of the Trinity is called the Holy Spirit. And when you think about this and the idea of the holy, or the one who is separate, it's this idea that God, first and foremost, is transcendent, that he's not like us. We often, you know, want to picture God almost like a, you know, bigger, more grown up version of ourselves. But the Bible says things like Revelation 15:4, "Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy." You know, nothing compares with God. He stands alone in his majesty, his otherness. He alone is creator. We're creature. And so when we think of God as holy, there's this moral aspect, but there's also this ontological aspect that he is in a whole nother realm in terms of his being, because he is not dependent on anyone or anything. Whereas that's all we know. We are dependent on everything around us, you know, food, water, gravity, air. And yet that's not how it is with God. And I think it's just interesting, you know, this is when Isaiah catches a vision of God in his throne room. He sees the seraphim calling out to each other, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And so when you think about what is the glory of God like, well, it's like it's a picture of his holiness, his splendor on display. And you know, Isaiah, as he responds, he basically keels over. He says, "Woe is me, for I am undone. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell with a people of unclean lips." And so again, that is that shocking reality for him, is that God is holy. And he is not, and he's seeing it for the first time as he comes into God's presence. When it comes to holiness and God's response to sin, there's this idea in the Bible, really all through the Bible, not just in the Old Testament, but of the wrath of God. So what are some misunderstandings or misconceptions a lot of people have about the wrath of God?
Yeah, so when it comes to the wrath of God, I think the obvious one is, at least what you hear most often, is that God is mean. You know, God is vengeful. And we obviously know that's not true of God, because God also describes himself as love, not something he does, but something he is. You know, so there's a degree to which you have to argue that God's wrath is centered in God's love. And I think one of the other common, you know, comments is, if God is loving, then he shouldn't have any wrath at all. In fact, he should just, you know, love and support people and tell them they're fine. You know, they're good. It's all good. Give them a pass. And yet the problem is that God is just, and that's also loving as well. So, you know, we associate this a lot with a good judge. You know, a good judge cannot look, overlook, you know, some wrongdoing that's been done, because that would be an unjust judge. And, you know, you see the same thing with God. For example, in Habakkuk 1:13, it says, "Your eyes are too pure to approve of evil." You know, can't just, well, it's okay, we'll just, you know, set it aside. It says, you cannot look on wickedness with favor. You cannot look with favor on those who deal treacherously. This reality, recognizing that, yes, God is love, but God is also righteous, and God's righteousness does not allow God to overlook sin, to overlook the evil that goes on. And God's also just, and justice of God requires that the result of evil be dealt with. And this is not, you know, this is not, again, a crazy concept, because we expect it as well. Even in our human, you know, system, which is very broken, we get very upset when we see injustice happen. We don't say, oh, what a good judge that is. He allowed that person to get away with, you know, what evil thing was done. And the same thing would be true and is true of God. God cannot just. And so this wrath of God is not a vengeful, I will get my hunk of flesh. It's built out of the purity of God. It's built out of the character of God. It's built out of the love of God. It's built out of the justice of God. And so all of that comes into play when we're talking about the wrath of God.
Yeah, I mean, something I've noticed is that a lot of Christians, a lot of Christian preachers, in fact, are, it's almost like they're reticent to talk about God's wrath, or even like ashamed to bring up this fact that God is wrathful. And I mean, I think that what needs to happen is people shouldn't be talking less about it, but explaining what that means. Because so often when I have heard people describe a misconception, it's like they have this picture of a, you know, an abusive father who's just angry and wants to take it out on the next person, or, you know, like that person who wakes up on the wrong side of the bed and you know, wants to lash out at the next person who comes their way. And I think that when we're doing that, we're seeing God almost like one of the Greek gods, that they were very capricious, they were very maniacal, but they were very much like us, in that they got angry over things that are very human. But with God, he has a settled anger, and he is wrathful, but it's against evil. God hates evil. And Jamie, I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but if we didn't have a God of wrath, there's no hope for us. I mean, that is, I guess, the way to look at it, because people may think of it as a negative concept, but really, that's what people want. They want a God who will deal with evil and deal with wickedness, and there's no way to do that if God can't judge.
For sure, yeah. And actually, we would even argue, if it was not for God's perfect nature, including his wrath, that there would be no Jesus either. You know, why send a son? I mean, if God really did not care about purity and didn't really care about any of these things, then why bother with the human condition at all? So it actually, you know, it's really that two-sided reality. I mean, there's lots of good reason that actually, when we really think about it, we want the wrath of God. And here's the thing, we're made in the image of God. So we're made in some senses like God. And when it comes to justice and wrath, we're actually no different in that sense. Obviously, we're sinful and our wrath and our justice is perverted by our sin, resulting in a lot of injustice a lot of times, but these realities are very much real for us as they are for God. And that's, yeah, like you're saying, that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
I think it's also worth pointing out as well, one of the other things I was just thinking about is, you often hear people say, well, the God of the Old Testament was so wrathful, but the God of the New Testament is all love. And that's not true either. In fact, yes, God is a God of love. I mean, he declares himself to be that. You think of like 1 John 4:7-8, where, you know, he says, not only is he that, but if we are not that, then we're not of him. But at the same time, his wrath is made evident and revealed in the New Testament just as much as it is in the Old. You know, you think of Romans 1:18, for example, or Revelations 19:15. So you see this, it's not just an Old Testament reality. This is a part of the character and nature of God, and that's actually a good and beautiful thing. In fact, that's a thing worthy of worship to a great degree. It's another one of those attributes of the character and nature of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think some people just in our modern age, I guess, to put it bluntly, we are often so soft when it comes to these issues of true justice. Like that, for example, a lot of people would say they are against retributive justice. Therefore, you know, remedial efforts, remedial justice, where people basically efforts should be made to change people's lives and all treatment should be done, but nobody should be punished for doing wrong. Well, the problem with that is if we don't have a right concept of justice, we're going to say that, for instance, if somebody takes a human life, that human life they just took isn't actually worth as much as we thought, because now that murderer just has to go through times of treatment, and they don't actually get punished. They need to be treated. And so it opens up a larger issue, but I would say if we're going to understand God's wrath, we need to see that this is a matter of right justice being executed, because this is what we really need. And there's a final judgment that the Bible talks about. And this is something that, of course, with the atonement, as we get into that, this is why we need the cross, is to be spared from final judgment. And I would say most people, if they think about the cross in merely a sentimental kind of God just showing his love in kind of this abstract way, and there's not this actual just punishment where Jesus absorbs that wrath for us, then there's going to be a mistake and a misunderstanding of what the cross was really about.
Yeah, and it's very clear from the Bible's perspective that the cost of sin is death. I think of Romans 3:23, for example. For all have sinned, and Romans 6:23, the wages of sin, right? Wages of sin is death. The Bible's pretty clear about that. I mean, the cost of sin, and in fact, the law itself shows that through the atonement process, which doesn't resolve sin. It doesn't deal with sin. All it does is show you the cost of sin and the need for atonement to recognize. So all that sacrifice, all that blood, all those lambs and goats and rams and bulls, none of that forgives sin. All of that shows simply the cost of sin, and the reality of sin, and the fact that death is required to deal with the reality of sin.
And it's also important to see that because of the wrath of God and understanding what sin is, we can know for certain that that things like hell that's always perfectly good and just of God when he punishes people. And that's something that, I guess, for a lot of people who are coming at the issue of hell and they're thinking, you know, this is God just torturing people he doesn't like, or some other, you know, caricature of hell. If they don't come at it from the right perspective, where they see that this is because God is justly dealing with people who have rebelled against him, and that there actually will be different degrees of judgment. For example, if someone has been shown great opportunities, been shown the grace of God in so many ways, and they reject Christ, the more they reject or the more they know and the more they reject, there is actually a greater degree of judgment. Hebrews 10:28 talks about this. It says, anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. So, I mean, there you have it. It's not a matter of God being unfair. It's a matter of God being perfectly fair and perfectly just. And it's just the reality that we can't stand up to that fairness because of our condition without Christ. And that's why his grace is needed and his sacrifice is essential.
But there's really good news, obviously, in all of that. And we'll get into that as we move forward next week, talking about the solution that God presented for us, that God provided for us in himself.
You've been listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you want to subscribe, feel free to do so on iTunes or Google Play. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit us up on social media or send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. To hear past episodes, go to our website, faithunpacked.com. And as always, we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.